The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You are listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 90 is Sam Phillips, whose first album came out way back in 1983 when she played as Leslie Phillips. But after four albums of Christian pop music, she reemerged with a new name and a new career. And you are right now listening to Baby I Can't Please You from her 1994 album Martinis and Bikinis, the third installment in that second career. She has now released her 16th album, World on Sticks, and we'll be discussing I Want to Be You and Tears in the Ground from that album. And you should note that that has just now been released on vinyl, so go look for it. Then we'll look back to 2001, maybe the peak of her fame, with How to Dream. It's from the album Fam Dance, but if you've ever watched the show Gilmore Girls, you will definitely recognize this song, as she was all over the soundtracking to that. Conclude by listening to When I'm Alone from her 2013 album Push Any Button. For more information, please see samphillips.com. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. If you enjoy what's going on here, please go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic to sign up for a small per-episode contribution. All right, so I will have played a little of Baby I Can't Please You from Martinis and Bikinis 1994 to represent your early work. Of course, there's a whole phase, which I don't know if we're allowed to talk about before that. When you actually started releasing albums as Sam Phillips, this is the third of them, and kind of established that what you're probably still known for now, if not for the subsequent Gilmore Girls stuff that we'll talk about in a bit, can you give us a very quick picture in the trip, since we're about to hear something of World on Sticks, from that relatively early style of Baby I Can't Please You to what we're about to hear?
Oh, a long journey, but I love Baby I Can't Please You because the musicians on that, especially Colin Moulding from XTC, played bass on that, and at the time wanted to do kind of a Bollywood duet, which I will always regret that I did not agree to. Perhaps someday we'll do it. I think that would have been a brilliant idea, and I loved his voice and love XTC. But you know, that was then, this is now. So onward to World on Sticks, which we're about to hear I Want to Be You.
Yep. So your 16th album overall, including the prehistory ones, a lot under your belt. You're producing this yourself, right?
Yes. And I Want to Be You is kind of the comic relief of the record, talking about the staged idealism online that we're looking at constantly and celebrity. And it's just kind of a sad, funny song. I think we may have to, after all is said and done, relearn how to see others and see our world, because it's an odd kind of envy corner that we've cornered ourselves in on the internet.
I want to be you on the screen, on the street, on the stage. I want to be you in your clothes with your friends in a camera cage. I'm tired of myself. I'm tired of myself. I want to be you. I'm tired of myself. I'm tired of myself. I want to be you. Last I checked, I want to be you. I'm tired of myself. I'm tired of myself. I want to be you. I'm tired of myself. I'm tired of myself. I want to be you. No try, just to fail. No tired, normal, wanna be you, so strange and pale. I'm tired of myself. I'm tired of myself. I wanna be you. I'm tired of myself. I'm myself. I wanna be you.
So for a comic relief song, as you just described it, this is pretty sinister. There's a lot of nice atmospherics in here. This drone. Say a little about how you put this arrangement together, this very drum-dominated thing, paying attention to a lot of the acoustical details here.
This is the first time that I've written songs with the drummer that I work with, Jay Bellarose. I actually asked him to give me some drum performances, not even loops, but performances. And as he was playing this particular performance, I heard I Want to Be You actually in the rhythm of his performance. And so that's where I started and filled it out from there. But it was an interesting experience. We also wrote World on Sticks together and A Continuous Limit. I wrote both of those to his drum tracks, which is the closest I've ever gotten to actually being in a band. Well, no, that's not true. I was in a band with T-Bone Burnett and Sam Shepard and Gillian Welch called Void a long time ago, but it was short-lived. And it was only live. I don't think we ever did a real record of that.
So just the first note here. I mean, I'm listening to this drum hit. Here, I'll replay it for the people. That's a three-dimensional. That's not just a hit. There's movement in it. It almost sounds like he's doing the kettle drum and hitting the pedal, you know, to change the pitch while he's playing or something. Do you want to say a little about just how you recorded him?
Well, you know, Jay is, he's very mysterious because I've heard stories about the great singer Roy Orbison that he sang very softly into a mic, and with Jay Bellarose, you'll see him playing with his fingers a lot of times, and it sounds huge and monstrous. So it's all about tone with him, and Eric Gorfain recorded this and has worked with Jay for a long, long time. So to kind of understand what he's going for, I don't really say anything to Jay. I just play the song for him, and he figures out what to do around that. And I have the very fortunate situation of having had worked with him for, I guess, wow, over 10 years now, and really, I think, grown together as musicians. It's really interesting over time. And the thing that Jay and I have in common, too, is that I think we're always trying to push forward and not, it's kind of the good news and the bad news when you have a hit, because I think that you tend to want to repeat yourself a lot because you think, whoa, that worked. I got applause. People liked me for that. I sold records. Instead of pushing forward to grow as a musician, to do something different every time to get better. Since I don't have those high stakes, I've been delighted to be able to work with Jay Bellarose, Eric Gorfain, the Section Quartet, Jennifer Condos, Patrick Warren, some of these wonderful musicians over a decade.
The melody of this, what I sort of associated your early period songs like Baby, I Can't Please You, that just have these hooks that stick into you, when it seems like one of the ways to break out of that is, well, doing what you did here, is that it's not quite a rap, but it's certainly, it actually has quite a bit of melody for a spoken word in quotes piece. It still has the catchiness, but it's just, you have to rely entirely on the rhythm. You could have this kind of rap thing for the verse and then launch into a super catchy melodic chorus. But no, this is very consistent that you're relying on, you know, again, maybe it's because you're playing off the drums and trying not to invent a different thing that's on top of the drums completely, a different sonic world, adding a whole bunch of chords, but just to keep it very much like beat poetry. Do you want to say a little about how that approach has fit into your work here?
It's probably more blatant, my love of drums and rhythm. It's more blatant here, but I think I always usually start, sometimes I start with a melody, a free floating melody, but I find myself always having a feel in mind. Not that the feel always stays the way it is. A lot of times I've changed feels, or a lot of times Jay or earlier on a different drummer would come in and shape the song with a feel. during Martinis and Bikinis, I remember Chad Blake, when he was mixing the record, we had really loud drums, big toms on Strawberry Road, which is a ballad. It's funny to me now. I'm not sure why we did that. I really liked it. I thought it was cool at the time. But when Chad heard it, he pulled the drums off of it. And I think that was the right thing to do. It's interesting because I think that making records and even writing songs, even though usually I don't collaborate a whole lot with other people, I do think that when you bring a song out to the musicians and you have them play it, you hear it in a much different way. It's a big test. I've thrown songs out before because I felt like, oh, you know, I don't think this is as good as the musicians who are playing it. But it's an interesting test. It's an interesting thing to have that kind of collaboration. And also arrangement-wise, to work with producers like T-Bone Burnett, who I worked with for many years and learned so much from, and Chad Blake and the great Mike Persante. He's a wonderful engineer. I guess it takes a village, and all these beautiful performances from all these wonderful musicians that I've had the privilege of working with over the years.
Well, let's talk specifically about the strings here. The Eric Gorfain, he's got these, I wanted to say atonal, but it's in the mode. I guess I figured it out was Dorian mode, right? The flat third, the flatted seventh. I never remember those from day to day until I sit down. But so he's got these pizzicato strings adding this, not quite a solo. And then later he's got a bowed version of that. How are you choosing how to fill the space here? There's so many choices with basically a drum track and beat poetry delivery to fill the gaps there. Were you just letting Eric loose to do whatever he wanted, or did you have something specific in mind here?
I just let Eric loose, turned him loose on that track. There are a lot of strings on World on Sticks and a lot of string arrangements, and I had the great privilege to be able to work with Eric on these arrangements. I've worked with a great Van Dyke Parks on many of my records, and he's fantastic, and he does what he does, just amazingly, fantastically. But this is a little bit different in that Eric and I worked on some of the string arrangements together. I was able to listen to some of his rough drafts and help shape them with him. Sometimes I would sing him lines that he would incorporate into the string arrangement. So it was a lot of fun for me to step into that world. The other string arranger that is wonderful is Patrick Warren. I've worked with him as well. I remember asking him, you know, what can strings do? What can we make them do? And he just said, anything. We can make them do anything, which I love, because sometimes it's intimidating if you haven't really worked with strings, which a lot of us in pop or Americana or folk, whatever music, don't work with strings as much. And it can be a little intimidating, but so much fun if you're brave and you're collaborative and you work with the musicians, because there are a lot of very stiff classical musicians that are more difficult to work with. But on the other hand, there are wonderful players that do have a great feel. And that's why I love the section quartet, because I think they're rebels. They all like different kinds of music, from the avant-garde to punk music, R&B. They're really interested in all that, and they have great feel. They have great time.
Well, that sounds like a good transition to the second song, Tears in the Ground, because whereas in I Wanna Be You, the role of the strings is just, you know, it could be lead guitar, it could be any number of things. I just recorded a song where I had gaps like that, and I put heavy reverb on multiple recorders as if it was like little goofy noises like that. But in Tears in the Ground, you've got a more fully arranged, you know, obviously fully arranged, the full quartet is playing. It's an aggressive string part. It really takes a very strong role in determining the tone here. It's not just providing a drone, say. Do you want to say a little about Tears in the Ground before we play that?
It's got a nostalgic feel to it, which I think is appropriate because of the subject matter, you know, really kind of mourning for the environment, for the earth, what's happened with our civilization in the last 100 years, how we have not really taken great care of our planet. And now we're seeing, you know, the swift changes in the weather patterns and the water, you know. And it's funny because a lot of people have different reactions to politics or to issues like this. I feel that one of the most important stages in change is grieving, is seeing what's happening and mourning that first. And that, in a way, I think is the first catalyst for change, to feel the pain of what's happened to the environment, what's happened to the earth, and the fact that we don't have the clean water that we need, that's going away, that people are getting cancer at an alarming rate because of all the pollutants in our world. And money seems to turn a blind eye to that. People want the short term, the cash, the money, and not the long term preservation of life and our planet and health. So that's kind of a heavy statement, I know, to make in a simple song, but there's a lot of that weaving through this record world on sticks. And it's not a permanent situation, I think, according to our actions, but it's certainly a problem. And that's feeling like the world is on sticks. It's wobbly. That's kind of the whole premise of this record. And, you know, writing now to kind of do the answer to World on Sticks and writing about seeing where that takes me. I think it's a brighter side, perhaps.
I've been having nightmares like you wouldn't believe, all day long until I fall asleep. By the watermarks I keep finding, I know the flood has been here before. The earth has fever in her angry eyes. Our fires make the waters rise. As we're watching her gardens die, the future's falling from our eyes. Our tears in the ground. Tears. Our tears. Tears in the ground. Another beat down. One more break in the heart. My mind tears itself apart. And though I've fallen through the lies before, I won't stay down here anymore. I'll get up and leave my tears in the ground. Leave my tears. I'll leave my tears. I'll leave my tears, tears in the ground. You can't take the dreams out of us no matter what you do. No one will cry. No one will cry. Shake the sky for angels waiting under the night. I'll dig in the dirt for light. And though I've fallen through the lies before, I won't stay down here anymore. I'll get up and leave my tears in the ground. I'll leave my tears. Leave my tears. I'll leave my tears, tears in the ground. I'll leave my tears. I'll leave my tears. Leave my tears, tears in the ground.
This seems like one that could have been written as a free-floating melody, but on the other hand, that guitar pattern is so fixed in there, I can barely picture having the melody and then coming up with this dun da da dun da da. Like, did those two things come at the same time in this case?
No, the melody did come before that, although that was the feel.
How much, as you're working these things out, do these melodic flourishes get added? I mean, this is a very active melody. The watermarks I keep finding. Does it get more elaborate as you develop it, as you approach the recording time? Or is it pretty much whatever happens on the day is what it is?
It's both, because for instance, one of the songs, Candles and Stars, I remember I had kind of thrown my neck out and I believed in writing the song, but it was really hard. I had to work at it. I had the idea for it and some of the melodic pieces, but I really had to work hard to put it together, which is not typical. Usually it's just their inspiration strikes and I go with it. So I think, you know, as a writer, you have to be open to all of that. I think it's good to practice and write every day if you can, no matter how little. But also, I think one of the most important things about songwriting is that inspiration, that leaving room for that mysterious thing. Because I'm always suspicious of people that are trying to teach you to write songs. Because first of all, I think it's a gift. And I think that you can make a lot of, that you can work hard to keep fresh and to improve upon. But I don't know, I've never heard Bob Dylan really trying to teach people how to write songs. And he's one of the greatest writers that, you know, I know of. It still is a mystery. Even trying to listen to all the influences that influenced Bob Dylan or Paul McCartney or John Lennon, you know, even if you listen to all the music that they listened to, you still didn't live at the time that they lived. You wouldn't process it the same way because you're you, because you live in a different time, you're a different person. And I love that about songwriting. I love that there's a lot of mystery, a lot of things that we can't pin down, that we can't figure out, and that it's so individual.
Mm-hmm. This song in particular, it has in its vocal flourishes, it reminds me of some somewhat freeform blues, the, you know, where you can soar high or you can go low and you can really on the spot change the dynamics around. And there's a lot of interesting shifts in this whole song. You know, for instance, coming up to the bridge.
You can't take the dreams out of us no matter what you do. No one will cry.
We're finally getting to something that we've come out of the slow blues groove, but it actually only hits for just one line. No matter what you do, then it floats back down to earth again. You know, it doesn't have this extended bridge section. It's just really that one line. And then going into the last verse, it adds this little bit of funkiness that wasn't there before. Do you have these kind of dynamic shifts for the song in mind as you're writing it? Or is this more of a matter of, as you're putting it down, this is just what's coming up? Actually, I should ask you, when you're actually physically recording this, are you doing this with you and the rhythm section, or is it all just piece by piece?
Recording or writing?
It's a combination of things, because of course, what the drums are going to do are going to determine some of the dynamics up and down. Give us a picture of, yeah, your process in that.
This song is as is and is formed before the band or the strings or anything went on. It was basically an old-fashioned way of cutting a rhythm track and then adding strings. I'm flattered that you have gone into so much detail about the song, but you know, I feel that I'm always trying to understand the language of melody. Melody is maybe, I don't know, what I'm most fascinated with, and I'm slower with lyrics. Different melodies are saying things. I'll usually have a melody first, not usually a lyric, but it does work the other way too. But I think it's always interesting to try to figure out what the melody is saying, what kind of emotion it's conveying, what kind of an idea. I know that's kind of a crazy way, but melody is a different language. I'm not sure a lot of people see it that way. It can evoke ecstasy or sadness.
So that's interesting with this song, because as I was saying, it has a very strong, moving melody, but then you pass it off so that the strings are taking it through quite a lot of it, you know, just as if you had Eric Clapton sitting next to you, answering your vocal riffs with aggressive string. It had a sort of a Japanese flourish to me. I'm not really sure how to characterize the tonality. Did you kind of have the main string melodies in mind to answer your vocal melodies? Is that part of the song as you wrote it? Or is that just something that as Eric or whoever was arranging this was coming up with those particular answering melodies?
That's something that we worked on afterward to fit around the song. You know, except for, you know, some of this collaborative writing with Jay, the songs are pretty much as is. I know that a lot of people do write as they record, and I've done some of that, but I like to work on the melodies. I like to work on the songs a little bit more than that.
The other thing, arrangement-wise, I was pointing out, getting into this last verse where the bass just starts moving more and then continues like that into the last verse. So it changes the texture to make it a little more funky as we go here.
I'll shake the sky for angels waiting under the night. I'll dig in the dirt for light. And though I've fallen through the lies before,
I think this is the first verse where you have constant guitar plucking through it and the bass is moving a little more. It's a subtle shift. It's not reflected in the melody. So again, is this the kind of thing that gets introduced as you're actually laying it down to like, well, how can we just change the texture a little as we're going? Or is this in your, you know, there's nothing about those particular lyrics. I'll shake for the angels. Well, I guess shaking that would connote like we need to have a little more funk in this section.
I think that maybe the lyrics have come to a point and what the song and the kind of the natural flow of the song is coming to a point where it's sort of a breakdown. You're getting to the last thought of the song, that it's a very rough thing. I mean, digging in the dirt for light, that's pretty hardcore optimism, I would say. So it's kind of an intense moment there, I guess, lyrically. And we are at the end of the song. So I think it's just a natural, you know, again, it's an unspoken thing that I think with the musicians, everyone just kind of feels that. I think it's just playing a lot of music and these musicians having played my songs and feeling the song. It's not a very intellectual process. And it's really interesting to hear you breaking it down as such, because that's not the way I think of it. The way we do refine things, you know, I'll listen to a part, a bass part, or even the mix, because somebody could have easily played through that section. We could have not had it break down, and maybe I don't recall, it could have happened, and maybe we took things out and brought things down. But I know that the drums came down at that point to do sort of a breakdown before the last chorus. It's trying to feel the song and where it's going. That's why I love these musicians so much, because that's just something that I don't know. I guess you can point out in songs, you can kind of understand it, listen to a lot of productions and a lot of music and kind of hear that, but it's not something easily really taught, and it wasn't really something discussed. It was just sort of what they did. This is kind of the road we went down.
Since you were recording without the strings, right? Those got added after the bass and the drums and the guitar?
Yes.
It just seems a puzzling decision in the absence of that for Chris Bruce, the guitarist, to basically lay out until, you know, just a few riffs here and there until that point. So it makes me think maybe he wasn't laying out and it was just fixed in the mix, that you kind of pulled him out some sections, pulled him back some sections, just really well blended him so that when you hear it, you know, it's especially effective. The focus is on the strings through most of it, the arrangement.
Yes, I think that there were some editing of Chris's part, but also he's a sensitive animal. You know, he is not your typical guitar player. A lot of guitar players can come in and play a lot of stuff. And even one of my favorite guitar players, Mark Rebo, will vigorously play a lot of things, you know, a lot of different fields, like the great Jim Keltner, the drummer Jim Keltner. I once had him come in and he played one of the songs I recorded for Fan Dance three different ways. I mean, just back to back, you know, here's this way, and this way, which is fantastic, but also crazy because they're all good. How do you choose? And at that point, that's where I have to take the lead and be the songwriter and steer the ship the way I want it to go, which is also daunting with somebody as great as Jim Keltner or Mark Rebo, but that's my job and I have to serve the song, I guess, at that point. But yeah, I think there were a few edits. And of course, when things quiet down a little bit, you do hear Chris more in that section.
Well, let's talk lyrics before we leave this song. So you've got several environmentally conscious things commenting on the sad state of the environment. I mean, I see that the two that you picked out for videos, How Much Is Enough and American Landfill Kings, are just obviously about consumerism and the rape of the environment and et cetera, et cetera. And this one in particular, it slides from the political into the personal in an interesting way. And is that because you're taking the political personally, or were you using kind of a metaphor between these two things? In other words, the breakdown of the environment, but on the other hand, I've fallen through the lies before, I won't stay down. You know, it sounds like you're talking about interpersonal situations rather than being lied to by politicians or something like that.
One thing that was really important on this record, if there is resistance in it, was resisting the real root of all of the politics that we're seeing now, you know, because it's never just one person. It's sort of the spirit of an age, maybe, or a very classic good and evil, greed and sacrifice and generosity. You know, it's the light versus the dark. It's all that age-old stuff that we're always seeing played out. It's important for me as a songwriter to frame it from my point of view as a human, as one person in this world, feeling the wobbly world on sticks, as well as talking about these nefarious characters that are not helping that are in fact hurting. But I don't feel compelled to name them because I think we have them in every generation. I think it's a thing that we're always going to struggle against. Evil people, greedy people, you know, there are always loving people, people who are generous and who will sacrifice. It's just that age-old thing. I'm trying to address it from that very classic good versus evil, but also the personal of how it affects me every day. Like even American Landfill Kings, it wasn't strictly about the environment. You know, it was about my father passed away and I had to go through his things. And in going through all the things that he had, I tried to give it away to, you know, as much as I could to find homes for all his possessions. But at the end of the day, there were a lot of things that just no one wanted, no one could use, and they were loaded on a truck and sent to landfill. And that was stunning to me because I thought how everybody at least has probably that much stuff, if not more, to go into a landfill when they leave the planet. And that's a lot of stuff. And it made me look at possessions and building and our whole direction that we're going on this planet, you know, build more buildings and bigger and, you know, cover every inch of real estate with something, a business or a store or an apartment building so you can make more money. What about nature? Just kind of a stunning observation that I made in that. And that's very personal. That has wider implications, of course, because of, you know, the direction that we're going with progress and with building and with all of that. But it's also very personal to me because I'm, you know, a person mourning the loss of my dad and going through his possessions. So, and thinking, I don't want to have this much stuff at the end of my life that is just useless. I want to be able to find homes for things or not to collect as much. So it's kind of an anti-materialistic song as much as it might be about the environment.
And just again, how you're communicating these, it kind of goes back and forth between somewhat anthemic elements and very personal. The first time it's our tears in the ground, here's our tears in the ground. There are times, you know, with that bridge, it sounds like you can't take the dreams out of us. It sounds like it's going to grow to a, you know, we will overcome kind of anthem, social anthem. But no, it pretty immediately, no one will cry. No one will cry for you. That's more direct and mean and Elvis Costello-ish or something than you would get in a Pete Seeger song. And the effect of these strings, the way it ends, I'll leave my tears. And it sounds personal and mourning and blues-based rather than rallying cry, fist in the air.
Yeah, because I think that's part of it. I'm just not sure how we can respond to the rallying cry of a song. I think it was very appropriate for Seeger at that time. I'm not sure how relevant it is right now because it's complicated. And I think that gets kind of preachy and you feel like you're in school, you know, or in church or something. I think that that kind of an approach is just not as maybe moving or compelling as trying to take it from a personal point of view. We're bombarded in a very, very different way at this point in time with information, with politics, with all of it. It's a really unusual time, I think, in history. And, you know, I find myself with information being, I have to be very careful because one could tend to listen to the news in the car, you know, read it online, you know, first thing in the morning, read it again in a few hours on the phone or on another device, as well as talking about it with other people during the day. And there's television. There's just so much coming at you all the time. That now I think we have a responsibility as humans. We have to edit that. We have to save a little bit of mental real estate and emotional real estate for ourselves every day. Maybe that's even in there a little bit, trying to take things personally at some point because we're not just commenters on websites. We're humans, you know, and that's the other thing. And interesting watching people deal with each other online, I think in a way that they would never deal with each other if they were sitting down for a meal. You know, I think there would be a lot more compassion, maybe a little bit more listening than there is online, which tends to be a lot of screaming with your fingers in your ears. Although I am seeing people getting away from that, being more kind. I hope that's a trend that will continue. But I suspect that screaming at people with your fingers in your ears is also a trend that's very human that will probably continue as well.
You're saying that the methods of Pete Seeger are somewhat outdated, that a lot of that has to do with our means of communication, that by providing an example, I won't get fooled again, I'll leave my tears, I'll be optimistic. And you're talking directly in people's ears, you know, through their headphones, not in a giant, of course, you're still doing gigs, but the prototypical way of motivating people, at least for someone like me who doesn't get out of the house as much as perhaps I should, whether it's through the internet or through listening to things directly, even though you're still, it's mass communication still, but it seems very individual. It seems very personal, so that you can try to change the world through providing an example, you know, whether it's inspiring people to meditate. I mean, that's kind of what this song seems to be, is an example of the kind of reflection on social issues that's bringing in spiritual imagery, shake the sky for angels, etc. And that's the way that you're actually speaking through a megaphone to many, but it doesn't have the cosmetic appearance that it would if you were actually out in the public square screaming. You can be very soft and very, and still actually probably be more politically efficacious by affecting one individual at a time in a way that feels personal to them.
I think it's good for all of us to have more of a dialogue. And I guess I don't think necessarily that his way of communication and his beautiful songs are outmoded or outdated necessarily. I think there's a place for that. But I think that some of them can be, you know, very one message oriented. And I think what I felt more compelled to do was to just maybe say, consider this, you know, would you consider looking at it differently? Because I certainly have started from one place and in my, you know, life ended up in a very different place as I've encountered more ideas and different people. And I'm sure that Pete Seeger's music has done that as well. But I just think it's more important than ever not to hit people over the head with things. There's a place for grandstanding, for getting up and making the big statement. But even in like the very grand big statement, like a band like U2, I think that they leave a lot of room for, you know, emotion and different thoughts. And I think they do it in a really beautiful way. But we're dealing with such a broken system in that, in a good way, I think, we have a lot of different cultures, a lot of different ideas, you know, and I think the breaking up of just one TV channel or, you know, I think is a very good thing and can't be underestimated. So it's also trying to be sensitive to that, that people are coming from a lot of different places and from a lot of different backgrounds. And I don't know how we put that all together, but I certainly think it's important to try.
Well, this seems like a good transition to our third song, How to Dream, looking back to 2001's Fan Dance. Gilmore Girls watchers will certainly know the melody here, which, you know, what we were just describing in terms of Tears in the Ground is a political song, but is also personal. Well, in other words, it's descended from something like How to Dream, which is healing in a kind of more traditional way that songs, that I think of songs as being healing. Why don't you give your introduction to the song and where you were at this point when you recorded it, and then we can talk more about the themes and the content.
I had the very unique and crazy opportunity in 2000 to take all of my, you know, unfinished songs and apply them to this score, to the show that I really loved called The Gilmore Girls. And How to Dream was a pre-existing melody that I could not get out of my head that I really loved. And I, again, trying to figure out what it was saying. And it was interesting because the creator, Amy Sherman Palladino, responded to that melody. She loved that and used it in a lot of different situations, emotional situations in the show, you know, over the years, over the six seasons that we worked together. So it was interesting to have it be a melody first and then to fill it out as a song. And I do think that when we open our eyes and dream, it has kind of a dreamy quality. It was also interesting because the way I recorded it on Fandance was very stripped down, very almost severe. It just has nothing on it. And I think that the melody could have a lot of harmonies and it could have a lot of strings and different parts. And I have done a version with strings too. But I love that about the early Beatles songs too. I love that they left a lot of room to the imagination. They did those songs with a four piece, but if you wanted to fill them out with strings, which, and you wanted to redo them, which so many people did, so many people covered, you know, their songs, even their early songs, you could make, you know, these very elaborate things out of them. I think I will always have a great fondness in my heart for those early Beatles songs that just had the bare bones. And there's something to be said for stepping up to the plate and laying out a song like that. Will it fly? Will people understand it? Will they get it without all the embellishment? Maybe, maybe not. But I like trying. And I guess if anything can be said of me as an artist, I guess it would be I'm stubborn. I'm very, very stubborn. When I get the idea in my head, that's the way I want it to be. And I'm very lucky to work with people who have worked with me on that. For instance, T-Bone Burnett. he used to, a lot of times, you know, if he disagreed, which was actually rare for a producer and artist, and we did, you know, quite a few records together, if we did kind of go head to head, a lot of times he would just say, well, it's your album, it's your record, and walk away. So, which I really do admire, because he's a strong personality and has great taste and is usually right. I found in working with him, he has an amazing sense of a good performance of, you know, when to stop, when something is finished, which is, I can't tell you what a great help that is when you're recording and trying to make a record.
Yeah, so wonderfully stripped down recording here. Is this Jim Keltner who does come in eventually on drums? He's playing a little at the beginning and then by the middle is playing full on.
No, this is Carla Azar.
Oh, okay.
An amazingly wonderful drummer. And this was such a wonderful collaboration with her too, because again, because there's so little on the track, I felt that her drums evoked feeling as well on this. And I don't know if anyone else hears the subtleties of the song with Carla's playing, but I certainly do. And I think she's an amazing and gifted musician.
I didn't even really register until I sat down to kind of chart this out that she's playing at the beginning at all, because it's just this very light cymbal thing. It really is so focused on, it's not even the melody, it's the harmony. It's those two parts together, like that is the lick, and that is the thing with the guitar that just dominates your brain and catches hold of it and spins around in there endlessly.
Carla's doing a beautiful thing there, because she probably is one of the loudest, hardest rock drummers, you know, on one hand. I mean, she's played with Jack White and her own band, Autolux. But it was interesting in working with her on some of these softer things, how sensitive she is and can be. She's really an amazing musician.
Lyrically, it seems like the rest of the lyrics came years after the initial riff and after you'd already put it in the score and now you're trying to make it into a full song. How difficult was that to come up with, you know, the rest of the theme?
It wasn't a riff, it was a melody, almost, you know, fully formed. So it really was, again, trying to interpret crudely what the melody is trying to say. And I did the best I could. You know, it's one of those things I'm not sure. Because again, I'm trying to work in a different language. I'm trying to put two languages together. I'm trying to say what I think the melody is saying without words, but yet I'm trying to say it with words. I guess it's kind of a crazy, impossible thing that we try to do in songwriting. In my head, if you're trying to do it the right way or the most compelling way, it's not easy. But I guess that's why I just keep doing it. It's a habit I'm not sure I'll ever be able to give up.
And can we get into a little of what this means? Like, under normal, we change the wind, facing every direction. Plant in the future, we live two lives, all to reveal a secret we can't hide. Yeah, what is this under normal, we change the wind? Like, this is what made me think that it wasn't just we open our eyes and dream. In other words, we have goals and develop a meaning to our lives and things like that. But we change the wind. Well, we don't change the wind under normal circumstances. This almost sounded like you were trying to say you're trying to impose dream logic on the waking world, you know, taking it more literally than just dream in the colloquial sense.
Well, I think it's just underneath. Perhaps I should have said underneath normal. I think it is talking about that logic just only goes so far. And we're not just logical mental beings. We're physical, we're emotional, we're spiritual. We're in a world that is completely out of our control, or almost completely out of our control. And really, the only things that are within our control are our minds. And even then, they run off, you know, with us. So, and we have to teach them, and we have to have disciplines to be able to not let our, you know, our minds run away with us, with whatever these engagements that make us crazy and paranoid and unhappy. Again, it's all the theme of when we open our eyes and dream. We open our eyes, and that's talking about, yeah, the waking dream, bringing some of that imagination, that letting go, bringing the part of us that goes beyond logic, that intuitive part of us, bringing that out of the dream world every night and bringing that into real life and letting that shape things and push things. You know, I'm not sure how much of that there is in big business, in corporate life, in political life. I think that all of those areas in our society could use a little more of the dream world and of the intuition, because I think it would lead us in a better direction.
Pulling toward deep affection, weights and numbers measure a world that won't heal. Yeah, it's a particularly poignant moment in there. You just set up this feel-good melody in the first place. You know, the whole song is like a soothing balm that goes over you. And I think that kind of guides the interpretation of the lyrics, that it sounds like some of it you're saying it's a wound that won't heal, but there's something, this song itself, pulling toward deep affection, that whole way of extending yourself is the healing.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to interpret it. I think it's important to not have one. Certainly there are songs just that are very much simpler, with much simpler ideas, but I like songs that have different interpretations and can be open to interpretation. You know, I don't want the conversation to be completely one-sided, and I don't want to overwhelm the listener. I want the listener to be able to have thoughts and dream and muse and think or feel. I don't want to just take over somebody with lyrics. It's interesting because there is a thing in songwriting that can get very claustrophobic and overwhelming for me in a very personal way. You know, people can get very detail oriented and get away from poetry. And sometimes that's good, but other times I think that can get really oppressive or boring. To me, it's important to leave room for people to actually get into the song.
And I'm wondering if it's somewhat of a prison. Is there an expectation that your music is going to be warm and fuzzy and healing? I know that in breaking away from your first pre-Sam Phillips career, that there was something like that going on, that there was a certain, this is the product you put out and it makes people feel a certain way. Did you get something comparable from getting re-famous, extra famous from something like this that is just, you know, warms you up just by hearing this initial riff, that now that when you do, you know, I Want to Be You or something, or these other, you know, you'd had many years of darker, more sinister stuff after this, even previous to this and concurrent to this. Is this song too successful that you feel pigeonholed at this point?
I don't feel pigeonholed at all, because I just don't feel that important in terms of...
Okay.
In some ways, it's a really lovely feeling, but it's an odd feeling of being sort of a specter. If you want to put me in the context of the music business or the music world, I feel kind of, I wouldn't say invisible, but really on the edges and more of an observer and doing my own thing. It's just really what I expect, I think, of myself and how I am trying to move forward to the end of my life and finish strong.
Maybe there's been a change in the music industry, or just you have the optimal level of fame or something that, you know, a group like Chicago or REO Speedwagon, once they did a super ballad in 1982, they were really never allowed to do anything else again.
That's an interesting point. I think, yeah, people do attach, you know, there's nostalgia attached and memories attached to music that has been so successful that it was constantly playing. You know, and in a way, I think it only pigeonholes the people that if they want to be pigeonholed in their minds. I mean, Scott Walker is a really interesting example of having had hits and he just went off into his avant-garde, willfully into his avant-garde music. So I think anybody can do that. But it is an interesting thing, you know, what happens, like, for instance, to a song like Stairway to Heaven. You know, I feel like I can't hear that song because I've heard it so many times in a certain context, you know, on the radio at a certain point, and then even many years after, that it's just, I can't really hear it. If I didn't hear it, you know, maybe until the very last day of my life and heard it again, maybe I would be able to hear it, but I don't know. And I think a lot of songs are like that. Hit songs are kind of connected to a certain time in your life. And that's a wonderful thing too. You know, you can feel like you're 5 again or 19 again or 30 again. I do, when I listen to sometimes my older recordings, things will come back. I'll have memories of recording the songs, but it's interesting singing them over the years. That's a whole other dimension that, or experience that will make me hear the songs in a different way or feel differently about them. And of course, always, I think going back to recordings, I don't think there's ever been a perfect recording, you know, that I've ever done. I might have gotten sort of a basic impression of the song across, but I'm sure that, you know, it can always, a recording can always be improved upon.
Some of that, the Stairway to Heaven phenomenon, maybe that, again, it has to do with the newer way, the dissolution of the popular culture and radio way of delivering songs en masse, that there are so many things. And also it just depends on your time of life, that as you get older, you're probably not hanging around parties and having roommates that are playing things at you, and just all these ways of getting music that you did not choose to listen to. It's completely different if you, discover Zeppelin on your own and are listening to in your headphones at your own pace, which is, I'm sure, is what a lot of kids do now if they're discovering Zeppelin, rather than having it thrust on you by classic rock radio or whatever for years and years and years.
That's a really good point. And I think that question that they would always ask in interviews from the very beginning, you know, when I was just starting out in music, you know, what are your influences? What music influenced you? And I've always thought that was an impossible question to answer because of exactly what you're saying, because there was so much music, not only on the radio that was forced on us, but in ads, in advertisements, and also, you know, TV and movies, you know, theme songs, underscore, all kinds of music that influenced us that we didn't really choose to let into our minds, our memories, but that were nonetheless. So that's an interesting thing too. In a way, your musical influences are kind of out of your control. Certainly you gravitate towards one thing or another, but I so often saw it just become a game of who can, you know, give a cooler answer than anyone else of like, oh, I like this thing because it was really cool. It was very obscure. And I felt that a lot of times that it was a very disingenuous trying to make something up that might've been partially true, but wasn't, you know, really true. But then, as Bob Dylan said, if they've got you answering the wrong questions, they've got you. So it's just, I think we should just throw that question out. I think that's a bad question.
To give an adequate answer to that involves, okay, well, here's the stuff that I officially like and that I try to associate myself with. And here's the stuff that infected me that shows through my work anyway. I hope when people get beyond age 30, at least, they stop having to make that distinction so much. I hadn't listened a lot to your earlier albums too well, like the Indescribable Wow as a younger person. I think the first one that I heard was the album after that. And for some reason I played I Don't Know How to Say Goodbye to You like a dozen times in the past week, because it's just one of those instantly warming earworms. And I don't know if when I was younger, I would have thought that was a guilty pleasure or something, you know, that is that sort of instant joy. But at this point, like, I don't care. It's just catchy. I just like it.
It's actually a delight to see kids now hearing this old music and how they respond to it, whether it is the Beatles or Fleetwood Mac that so many kids love right now. It is delightful because without that context, I guess that's another test. Without the context of it being a cool thing and being on the radio all the time, would somebody like it if they heard it? Very, very interesting. And, you know, we can talk on and on about all that kind of stuff. Music is fascinating and mysterious, and that's why we love it. That's why I love playing it and singing it and recording it and writing it.
Well, instead of going on and on, let's just introduce the last song and say goodbye. So speaking of catchy, but in a different way, you chose When I'm Alone from the previous album to this one, Push Any Button 2013, which is a fast little shuffle. You know, it's super catchy, but it's definitely not in the power ballad or anything like that genre of some of your earlier stuff. Do you want to say a little about where you're at with this and what you're going for with the song before we let you go?
I actually wrote this for a group which will remain nameless that was doing more of a nostalgic sort of music, country music at the time. I don't even know if they ever heard it. I did play it for their producer, but they didn't choose to record it. But I loved my little reject and just thought, you know, it's a great sentiment to write a song to, that, you know, being lonely and being alone are two different things. And I think it's a really important distinction because in this culture, we are isolated a lot and more as time goes on. And I think that doesn't mean you have to be lonely because there are so many wonderful things to be alone with.
All right. And yes, it seems like it's the same band for the most part, Jay and Jennifer and those folks from the current album that we've talked about. Yeah, thanks so much for doing this. It's been a pleasure immersing myself once again in your music for the last week or so.
Mark, I so appreciate you taking the time to do that in this day and age. I know that time is valuable. So I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and to listen.
All right. When I'm Alone.
Thanks so much to Sam. This is one of my favorite interviews,
And one of my favorite experiences prepping for this, her music really gets very addictive. I really recommend that you go to samphillips.com or look her up on Spotify or Bandcamp or whatever and just pick an album and listen to it 3 times, and I'm pretty sure it will stick. My next interview will be with Rachel Taylor Brown, a brilliant indie songstress from Seattle with a very unique style. Or perhaps you'd like to dive back in my catalog, for instance, to the Colin Moulding interview. Sam referred to him at the beginning of this episode, and I have an update about that, in that Colin has now retired his TC&I project and is putting music once again on the back burner. So it seems like I managed to get him in an interview in the very narrow window where he was doing music again for the first time in a long time. So I'm sad that there will not be more music by that group or by him probably anytime soon, but very excited that I got to talk to him when I did. There are a lot more good interviews on the horizon. I most recently finally spoke to the father of home recording, R. Stevie Moore. You should definitely look him up if you've never heard of him. He's got literally hundreds of albums, and many of the songs are quite good. Again, if you'd like to hear more of these, you want this podcast to keep going, keep interviewing awesome people like Sam Phillips, I need your help. Please go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic and set yourself up for a small per episode contribution. If this thing does not start paying for itself eventually, it will eventually stop. So help me stop it from stopping by pitching in. Lastly, I want to mention that if you live in the New York City area, my other podcast, The Partially Examined Life, will be doing a live show on April 6th at the Caveat. So you're going to want to keep an eye on partiallyexaminedlife.com for more information about where to buy tickets. Most of all, keep on musicking. This is Mark Lintonmeyer signing off.